Hi, Laura Murphy-Oates here. Today we're replaying an episode from our global news podcast, Today in Focus, that looks at psychedelic drugs and their mental health benefits. It may seem like every few months there's a new story on this. I've done a couple of stories on this over the years myself. But this episode delves into some pretty exciting developments happening in rigorous medical trials worldwide that are examining the therapeutic benefits of drugs like MDMA, LSD, and psilocybin. While this episode speaks to researchers in the UK and the US, this is also happening in Australia, with clinical trials in Melbourne and Sydney looking at the benefits of psilocybin in treating things like addiction, anxiety, and depression. Plus, a decision by the Therapeutic Goods Administration about whether to downschedule MDMA and psilocybin, making it more readily available for clinical therapies, is expected by December this year. I'll include some links to Guardian Australia's reporting on this at the full story page. But for now, here's Today in Focus host, Rachel Humphreys.
Robin, when you were growing up, were you ever around people who used psychedelics, maybe at festivals or in clubs?
Yeah. At the time when I was growing up, you know, there was the whole dance music thing and the tail end of kind of rave culture.
This is Robin Carhart-Harris from the Centre for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College London.
I grew up on the south coast and there were quite a lot of drugs around on Bournemouth where I grew up.
You just have so much energy. You just feel like dancing forever. You can't stop dancing. Even when you're walking around, you're dancing.
Yeah, it doesn't take long to encounter psychedelics.
In pioneering experiments, he and a team of researchers have been trying to find out if psychedelic drugs can be used to help people with depression. When you tell people what you do for a living, are they ever envious? I mean, you're getting to research the impact of psychedelic drugs. For some people, this must sound like kind of a dream job.
Yeah, they probably are a bit envious, yeah.
Scientists across the world are experimenting with illegal drugs and producing evidence that suggests ecstasy, magic mushrooms, and other psychedelics should now be considered as therapeutic tools. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, can you treat mental illness with psychedelics? Do you know how they came up with the word psychedelic? Well, I think I can imagine, but...
Well, I can tell you. Psyche is an ancient Greek word really meaning soul. And the other bit means to make manifest or to reveal. So Humphrey Osmond and Aldous Huxley felt that they needed to capture this, in their mind, key property of these drugs and soul-revealing compounds. That's what psychedelic means, soul-revealing.
And you're trialling using a psychedelic called psilocybin, which is the compound found in magic mushrooms. And you're doing this as part of therapy for people with depression. Do we know how many people in the country have been diagnosed with it?
In the UK, roughly about 10% of people suffer from depression. If you broaden it to mental illness, it's closer to one in four. And part of the reason for that might be that we don't really understand it well enough. We don't understand why it happens. And so we typically have thrown drugs at mental illness, but they haven't really made enough of an inroad. And as I said, the prevalence isn't going down.
It's clearly important that more research is done into possible treatments then. Tell me about the trials you and your team are running with psilocybin. How do you select people and what kind of safety checks do you do?
So we begin an eligibility process. We screen people for their suitability for the trial. If they're passing all these assessments and it looks as though they're suitable for the trial, we'll begin the therapeutic process. And that begins with preparing for the psychedelic dosing session itself. And so to prepare, we try to build a strong therapeutic alliance, a sense of rapport between the patient and the psychotherapists. And the way we do things traditionally is to have two therapists per patient.
Are people ever nervous when they begin this sort of trial?
They're often very, very, nervous doesn't do justice to it. They're often terrified, really.
Really?
And it takes...
Well, because a lot of people have a lot of fear around these drugs, obviously.
They do, and there's a lot of misperceptions and popular myths about them. People might think they'll lose control. And there is a kind of control that is lost, but you might call it ego control or a sense of kind of directing where your mind goes in a very... sort of controlling way. That is given up, but what's left isn't some, you know, raving maniac. It's more that you start to see into deeper aspects of your soul, if you want. And that happens with these compassionate, caring mental health professionals with you. So the patients have brought a dish, quite an ornate dish actually in our trial, gold leafed, and in the dish there are five capsules, white capsules. There'll be five capsules containing 5 milligrams each, so 25 milligrams. Quite a big dose of psilocybin, the compound found in magic mushrooms.
Wow, they're having a good time on that then.
Well, sometimes they have an awful time. I mean, this is the thing. These aren't really rewarding drugs, you know, hedonic drugs that make you feel good in a simple way. These are more like confronting drugs. And the experience can sort of flip between these extremes, sometimes in a kind of unpredictable way. But the way we treat that is to say, look, this is all learning material.
Okay, so participants go through two dosing sessions with therapists. Can you explain how the psilocybin works? What does it do to someone's brain that persuades you to think this could be helpful for people with depression?
So the psilocybin, in a sense, hijacks a system called the serotonin system. Serotonin is a chemical messenger in the brain, and so the serotonin system is a way that the brain is kind of tuned or modulated. And so the psychedelic's coming in and it's sort of tuning the brain in a kind of turbocharged way. The part of the serotonin system that the psilocybin is working on is involved in something that we call plasticity, which essentially is your ability to open up so that you can experience more of yourself and more of the world. It makes you very sensitive and sensitive to change.
And so essentially, this is sort of talking therapy, but on magic mushrooms. Is that too simplistic?
Well, it's a little different to talking therapy, and that's really because it's very difficult to talk under the influence of a psychedelic. And so the talking does happen, but it happens before and after the psychedelic journey. And during the journey, it's more of a kind of internal, people usually have their eyes closed or they put a blindfold on and visions play out. So the talking is generally done before and afterwards.
And after a couple of these sessions, what do some participants say about how they feel and if they notice a change, what that change might be?
I mean, in the most dramatic cases, they say they feel like a new person, that they don't have their depression at all anymore. And so they enjoy life more, they feel more able to face life and the world and go back to work and such like. They can also say that they feel particularly thin-skinned or sensitive. And so that has to be taken into consideration. It's not just a, you know, one-way ticket to wellness. There can be some, you know, destabilization and a kind of heightened sensitivity after the sessions as well.
You know, you're giving vulnerable people illegal drugs. What are the ethical considerations you and your team have to make when you're conducting these trials?
That's true that we're giving vulnerable people potent drugs. I think the legality is sort of an irrelevance. You know, as a scientist, you're trying to do ethical work, not do harm and to do good. And so that's the science that's motivating us along. The evidence says we can do more good than harm here. There are benefits to be had. In fact, this is a treatment that could turn someone's life around. So the ethics can be turned on its head. You know, you have a vulnerable person who's in a vulnerable state, who's in a risky state at that time. Perhaps they, you know, have suicidal thoughts or even planning, and so their life is on the line. Often, you know, when we see people in our depression research, they talk about how they've had plans, you know, to take their life, and this might be kind of last chance saloon. But absolutely, people shouldn't trivialize psychedelics.
Magic mushrooms are a Class A drug in this country. What does that mean for using them in your research?
It means it's more complicated and difficult to do the research. We have to have a license from the government, from the Home Office, to have the drugs on site. And there are quite a few details that we need to abide by in terms of a fridge bolted to the wall and a lot of sort of security steps and protocols around this. And you have to pay for the license. So it certainly doesn't make it easy. The curious nature of the situation is drugs that are a lot more harmful, like opiates, are actually much easier to do research with. So there is a kind of disparity there, an inconsistency between the harms of psychedelics versus, you know, the way they're restricted, that has unfortunate implications on research.
From these trials, Robin, what results have you had so far?
When we looked at remission rates at the end of the recent trial that we performed, which had two groups, one of the groups gets a conventional antidepressant, a drug called escitalopram. You get 6 weeks of that, or you get randomized to the psilocybin arm. And then we make a comparison. And so remission rates, what percentage of people met the criteria for remission at the end of the trial, the remission rate was twice as high in the psilocybin group relative to the escitalopram group at the end of the trial. While the rates of self-reported side effects were similar across the conditions, the nature, and I think it's fair to say the severity, was worse in the escitalopram group. We had significantly higher rates of drowsiness, emotional blunting, sexual dysfunction. And the paper's reported, it's now published in the New England Journal of Medicine, it's reported in a very conservative and cautious way. But if you look at the data and you look at just simple values, I mean, there's no spin here. You're twice as likely to be free of your depression at the end of the trial if you receive the psilocybin. I know that might sound incredible, and it is it's an incredible situation that we're in.
Okay, but we should say this was a pretty small-scale trial that involved 59 patients. And in the paper you wrote about it for the New England Journal of Medicine, you said that it'll be essential to do larger and longer trials to get a clear sense of how psilocybin compares to established antidepressants. How far away do you think we are, Robin, before psilocybin or magic mushrooms could be prescribed to help treat depression?
Yeah, we might be 4 years away from seeing psilocybin therapy licensed in Europe and North America to treat depression. And in that time, it's worth listeners realizing that psilocybin therapy has just been legalized in the state of Oregon. There's an expanded, what's referred to as a special access program in Canada, where you can make an appeal to the Canadian Health Authority to receive legally psilocybin therapy. So there are changes that are already beginning to happen in progressive jurisdictions in the world.
Coming up, some of these more progressive therapies are being trialled in America. We speak to a scientist there who is experimenting with MDMA as a treatment for PTSD. In America, psilocybin has been awarded breakthrough therapy status for treating depression, which means the process for reviewing it has been sped up. But researchers there haven't just been looking at the impact of classic psychedelics like psilocybin. For years, they've been trying to find out if so-called empathogens, drugs like MDMA, which is also known as ecstasy, can be used to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Rachel Yehuda has been a leading expert in PTSD for over three decades. A few years ago, she went to Burning Man Festival, which takes place each year in the Black Rock Desert in Nevada, bringing people together to listen to music, dance, and for some, to take drugs.
How are you guys doing? You meet a lot of different kind of people at Burning Man, and you become open to new ideas.
Rachel didn't go to Burning Man to take drugs herself, but while she was there, she started to consider the possibilities that ecstasy could hold for people who have been through trauma. She met a team from MAPS, a drugs advocacy group that funds research into ecstasy and PTSD.
And I had to get over my initial bias that recreational drugs are probably harmful, more harmful than helpful. But when you're in a place where people seem to have a lot more knowledge and experience about something than you, the best idea is to listen to what they have to say and to be open to learning something new.
So how had you felt about psychedelics before that?
It just wasn't part of my world. I didn't have a negative bias about it, but I also hadn't had positive experiences. I do recall one thing. My son came home from a festival once and told me that he had tried psychedelics, psilocybin, and said to me that he was more himself on psychedelics than he had ever felt in his life. I was very intrigued by that. You know, I tried to swallow my initial reaction of, oh no, my son took drugs, right, into a more, well, tell me more.
I mean, that sounds very positive and a very different response from, I think, the one my mum would have given if I'd come home from a festival and said I'd taken mushrooms. I think she would have reacted quite differently to you.
No, I love it when people tell me the truth. So the last thing you want to do is make them regret that decision.
You're a professor at Mount Sinai Medical School in New York, and you've seen how trauma can affect people for years, how they might experience flashbacks or try to control what situations they're in to avoid being triggered by upsetting memories. What are some of the common treatments for PTSD at the moment?
The treatments that have been given the gold standard, like cognitive behavioral therapies and antidepressants, they can work for many people, but they don't work for all. And even in people that find some benefit in these therapies, most don't usually say things like, I have my life back. So I think with medicine, you can expect to have some of the obvious symptoms reduced a little. So if you are depressed and anxious, you might become less so. If you're feeling anxious or sad, it might allow you to sleep a little better. The problem is, if you stop taking the medicine, those symptoms might come back. And the cognitive behavioral therapies, you know, I'll be honest, they work well for some kinds of traumas that are usually a single trauma, kind of a blip in the screen of an otherwise really stable life. But when we're talking about somebody who might be in a more chronic situation like combat or with a lot of early childhood traumatic experiences over a very prolonged period of time, it's hard to pick one trauma. It's hard to focus on one event. So you need more of a strategy of how to confront what has happened in a way that allows you to move forward. And I don't think that the currently approved treatments do that well enough for enough people.
MDMA is commonly seen as a party drug. I wondered if you could explain how it works in a person's brain when they take it.
Well, when you take ecstasy, there's a flood of neurochemicals and neurotransmitters that are released by your neurons. So most notably serotonin and dopamine and norepinephrine. And you're bathed in all these neurotransmitters that are making you feel good, as well as a rush of hormones like oxytocin and, interestingly, cortisol. If you are taking it recreationally in a context of, I want to have a good time, maybe meet somebody I really like, you might find that you enjoy the music or you're dancing or that person over there is very cute. When you take it with the intention of healing, though, you still get the same neurochemical effect, but you do something different with it. And that is why this is such a fascinating treatment. If your intention is self-exploration and you're there in the presence of therapists who are guiding the process, then what happens is you turn a lot of that good feeling, guess onto whom? Yourself. And you feel kind of compassionate towards yourself. You feel very trusting of the therapists. which, by the way, is a very difficult thing for trauma survivors to do sometimes, trust people. But if those neurochemicals and hormones are all swirling around in the context of making you feel safe, then what happens is if you're in a relaxed environment with the right setting and the right music and not being overstimulated and not having the agenda of a party, you start to kind of go places in your autobiography, in your past. And the therapists are there kind of checking in with you. And while you're in the best possible neurochemical state, you can start to deal with some very difficult material.
What are some of the reactions people have to taking MDMA in these therapeutic trials?
Now, a lot of people will say when they take MDMA in the context of therapy, I don't know why they call it ecstasy. They're not having such a good time because, you know, they're talking about their trauma, but they're not having the same reaction that they might have without the ecstasy. And because there are three people in the room, there's an awful lot that goes on. The patient is alternating between really having a very inwardly focused experience in their head and then kind of stopping to talk about where they were and what they saw and what they did. And then a really important part of the therapy is that you talk about it afterwards for three 90-minute sessions, the first one being the day after, so that all of the stuff that happens, and it happens so fast on some level, but it also happens like you feel you had 10 years worth of therapy. So in a way, time is very efficient, but you want to relive it and you want to explore it and you want to be able to talk about what you saw and what you think it meant. And you have that opportunity. And by the third session, you've really been able to do quite a lot of work in a relatively short period of time.
So you've gone through extensive training on how to use MDMA safely in trials. And now you and your team are due to start your own, building on the evidence that's been gathered by other researchers. What will this involve?
We are going to be doing a phase two trial. And the trial that we are going to do is we're going to compare the effectiveness of two MDMA sessions to three MDMA sessions in combat veterans. And I'm very excited. We've spent the last year training a team of 25 to 30 therapists. And the question that we get asked most often by people that are being trained is, do we worry about addiction? Do we worry that people will start using these medicines the way we had to worry about opiates? And the answer is that when taken therapeutically, people get the medicine just a few times. It's a lot more talk compared to being under the influence. And that there's very little evidence to suggest that psychedelics are addictive. What's really important to understand about MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, this is going to be the most important thing that I have to say in this interview, is that the MDMA without the therapy isn't a therapy. It's the fact that you get to take the MDMA and then process traumatic events under the care of the therapists that leads to the positive effects.
You're using a drug in trials that is illegal to take recreationally, but from the 1960s through to the 80s, it was used in therapy in the US. When did it become illegal?
It wasn't technically illegal until the mid-1980s. It became a party drug, and as it became a party drug, and there were adverse events associated with a less than responsible use in some cases of MDMA, people started getting concerned. People had already been concerned about LSD and psilocybin and mushrooms. And although MDMA wasn't like that, at least the US culture was in the middle of a war on drugs. In fact, the government was scheduling them as dangerous compounds. The problem with the overreaction of scheduling the compounds was that it prevented science from being able to do research into its effects.
And that war on drugs, you know, that was happening in the 80s on the part of the government, you know, that's not the same now. But do you think there still is an unwillingness to investigate with these drugs, both on the part of the scientific community and also the wider public, a fear around this in the US?
We're just in a space now where we're trying to figure this out. Meanwhile, as people like myself, who I would call myself a mainstream psychiatry researcher, a mainstream, very conservative academic who has been in very conservative community settings like the government, as people like us get excited about it and study it in probably the most rigorous and responsible way possible, I think this is going to lead to a much greater acceptance. But we also don't want it to just be completely available in a way that can cause harm to people.
So how long could it be before MDMA is used to help treat PTSD in the United States?
If the results of the second phase 3 trial are anywhere near as good as the first trial results, then I think we're looking at maybe in a couple of years at the most. There's a lot of need. And I think I don't see that there are any forces that are against this. I think what's beautiful about this is that I think even the most conservative places that would have normally held this back are not saying no. They're just saying, well, how can we do it safely and responsibly? And I think we have a real shot at something that might yield a lot of positive gain for a very traumatized world.
Rachel, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Rachel Humphreys talking to Dr. Rachel Yehuda and Dr. Robin Carhart-Harris. Robin has written several opinion pieces for The Guardian, which you can find at theguardian.com. And I also recommend reading an article from Guardian Australia's science writer Donna Liu called Psychedelics Renaissance: New Wave of Research Puts Hallucinogenics Forward to Treat Mental Health. We've linked those on the full story page as well. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore, sound designed by Dominic Fitzgerald. The executive producers of Today in Focus are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Additional production by Daniel Simo. Okay, catch you tomorrow for a regular episode of Full Story.